Produced by PI Media.
Hi, and welcome to CP Radio, the Checkpoint Research Podcast. I'm Ran Levy.
I came across this report back in April.
Asil Kayal is a member of Checkpoint's Threat Intelligence Group and our guide for this episode of our show. Last year, she came across a report from Amnesty International, a UK-based NGO focused on promoting human rights. The report concerned a particularly dangerous spear phishing campaign.
I was reading through it, and some of the details in the report caught my attention, and I wanted to take a deeper look into this report, and that's basically how this whole investigation started.
Beginning in 2016, a small number of individuals began receiving emails which appeared to come from trusted sources. For example, some of the victims received an email titled Critical Security Alert from a no-reply address labeled Google Accounts. The body of the email began, quote, "As your security is our concern, Google announces a necessary update to make your account more secure. To activate the new update, please follow these steps," end quote. You might have noticed the imperfect English. Announces, for example, should be is announcing. Or maybe not. It's pretty close to correct. Yet there are a number of these subtle grammatical errors and incorrect capitalization of letters, which might have tipped off any victims looking closely. At the bottom, there was a red button. Update my security now.
But the phishing in this report wasn't the traditional phishing that we're used to. Basically, the attackers set up third-party applications for mailing services.
The most common phishing attacks will include a link or a file attachment, which, once clicked, initiate a download of some malicious remote access malware. The hackers behind these phishing campaigns, perhaps knowing that their targets were highly educated individuals, went a step further. They created a third-party application called Secure Mail, which at the onset looks as legitimate as any other application requesting access to your email account. Just for our listeners who might not be very aware of what the term means, what is third-party applications for example, for Gmail?
Yeah, so basically it's an application that's supposed to provide a certain service for the inbox, for example. So in this case, the attackers were using that and saying, your inbox or your email has a security issue, please click on this application that will fix it. And then the user would be led to this page and it would require certain permissions. Because again, some of those applications might need that. If you're using an app, for example.
There are very legitimate uses for these kind of authentication.
Exactly. So the attackers were really using that, and because they were based on, or the victims would be led to those applications from their email addresses and from Yahoo Mail or Outlook or Gmail, they would look also very legitimate, but the truth is the app was getting a lot of permissions.
Specifically, the app was requesting the permission to, quote, read, compose, send, and permanently delete all your email from Google, end quote. Now, yes, this seems bad, but security programs typically require significant permissions over the user's accounts and machines they monitor.
To read all of the emails and to monitor that and possibly change things in the inbox. So that's something that those applications don't require usually. And again, once the victim would click on confirm, the attacker would then have access to all of that and to all of their inbox and would be able to read all of their messages, basically.
That email accounts were being hacked wasn't actually the core problem here. It was a symptom of a bigger problem. Consider why a hacker would want access to your email account. Usually, it's so that we can use you as a springboard to send malware or spam to all your contacts. The goal is volume. The hackers in our story targeted very few people, only 33 recorded by Checkpoint, maybe a few more we don't know about. And they weren't using them to spread malware or spam. It's kind of like if somebody broke into your house and stole only one item. What's so important about that one item? Why didn't they go for all the other valuables criminals usually are after? There was much more work to be done.
And so I started by looking at the list of indicators that they provided at the end of the report, which just was a list of websites, about 40 of these websites. And I started gathering information about them and seeing the history of those websites and how they were being used since they were registered and from that point on. And that's how I basically started mapping the infrastructure myself and seeing the connections between all of them.
Asil was only just beginning to peer into a wide network of interconnected malicious websites. They shared a common origin and a common strategy for trying to seem legitimate when they were so clearly not.
Well, I saw that a lot of the websites that were used had names like mail or service or login. So they were trying to impersonate legitimate mail services, again, in this phishing attack. So the websites that they used were really similar to Google websites or Gmail websites, Yahoo Mail websites, and so on. And I noticed that pattern in the naming. And then when I looked into the infrastructure, I also noticed that a lot of the those websites resolved to the same IP addresses. So I also had connections in terms of the hosting services that they used as well, and also all of the IP addresses, which were in the same range or in the same net block. So I knew that the attackers were constantly reusing that infrastructure for their attacks, and I could possibly find new things.
The sites all tracked back to a Russian hosting service. But this didn't indicate Russian involvement. The hosting service also supports plenty of other unrelated malicious activity with Russian and non-Russian origins.
Then I started looking at the IP addresses that the websites resolved to, which again, I found out that there were a lot of IP addresses that had those associated domains with this activity. So I started looking at newer websites that resolved to the same IP addresses. And looking into that, once again, I found websites that were registered after the Amnesty International reports, newer ones that weren't really known before. And they also followed the same naming pattern. So again, using the words mail and service and whatnot in the domain name. And one of the websites I found was registered back in June, I think. And
it, June of 2019, we should say.
Yes. Yeah. And that one domain had an open directory, which also allowed me to view all of the backend code of the attackers and all of the scripts that they were storing on the server. So that really was kind of the
key finding,
exactly, the jackpot to this whole investigation. That's where I started this whole thing.
This was a critical oversight on the part of the attackers, like expert home invaders who forgot to lock their own doors. Asil and her team now had a view into the attacker's entire operation.
I found a lot of scripts there that the attackers were using on this website. I was able to download all of that, again, due to the attacker's misconfiguration of the server. So I was able to look through all of the scripts, and basically I found newer third-party applications that they were using for Gmail and Outlook. And basically, those third-party applications were now after Google Drive. So instead of asking for permissions to read all of the emails, now they were asking for permissions to view all of the files stored on Google Drive. So again, seeing the attackers kind of widening their scope and trying to access the victim's files as well. And then I also found other scripts that the attackers used to control the server and to store data in it, and also to delete certain things from the server, kind of their control panel, basically, a script that they would be able to send commands to.
As the research team dived deeper into the data, they found that phishing emails were just one aspect of a far deeper, more diverse, more comprehensive cyber offensive.
In those scripts, and basically in the configuration files of the third-party applications, I noticed that in the configuration files of the third-party applications, another website was mentioned. not the website I had, a newer one that I also had no idea about. And that website was inactive by the time I checked it, because it was registered back in 2018. When I tried to access it now, I had nothing. So I couldn't check its content, couldn't do anything, couldn't send it any requests, nothing.
That website is drivebackup.co, if I'm correct.
Indeed, yes. And I started looking for or trying to gather public information about this website, once again, investigating the history of its usage and so on. And surprisingly, I then found an Android application that communicated with this website. So that took me also in a different direction. And I tried to understand if that Android application was related to this entire activity or not.
Because up until now, what you had were websites trying to phish credentials and permissions from the user. And now, all of a sudden, you have another vector of attack, which is a mobile application.
Exactly. Looking into the code of the app, I saw that if I install it on a device, on an Android device, the name of the app would be iLoud 200%. And then the application itself would show messages or display messages to the user saying your ringtone is now 100% louder. Where in truth, looking into the code of the app, I saw that it did nothing with the ringtone at all.
The app that claimed to raise the volume of a mobile phone's ringtone didn't in fact do that at all. It was a malware. Now, can you guess why a hacker would be interested in designing a fake app targeting mobile devices in particular?
I looked into the permissions that the app was getting, and it was accessing the device's find location. So again, even more accurate coordinates of the device. And basically, I saw that the app had a service which would constantly send the coordinates of the device it is installed on to drivebackup.co. And if the user that installed the app would try to stop the app, or if it would stop because of any reason, then the app would respawn that service again. So it would just, it was kind of a persistence method, yes, to keep those coordinates up to date and to constantly upload them to the server.
An app like iLoud 200% was in some ways even more valuable than a hacked Gmail account. It was a way of keeping an eye on a target, no matter where they went, 24/7. iLoud 200% was still in development, but it traced back to yet another Android app, which was available on the Google Play Store.
And it was called Indexy or IndexY, and it was supposed to be similar to the Truecaller application, to the known Truecaller application, where you would look up a user or the name of someone and then it would give you back their phone number, or you would look up phone number and it would give you back the name of its owner. And this app required permissions to gain the user's or to access the user's contacts and call history, which is okay if you're a Truecaller service because you want to enrich your database and you want to have as many contacts as possible.
It's
to offer
a legitimate
exactly,
option.
Yeah, to offer a legitimate service. And once again, the Indexy application had another administration panel or another control panel hosted on indexy.org. Once again, this panel was misconfigured, so I could access the styles directory, and I was able to view the templates of that admin panel without logging into it. And I saw that the developers behind it were abusing those permissions, to say the least, because they were storing tables of how many users per country were there, and are those users making calls abroad.
To review, the hackers were breaking into email accounts, Google Drive accounts, and placing trackers in the phones of maybe a few dozen people. This was no ordinary cyber criminal behavior. This was direct targeting of specific people with a goal of getting specific information about where they were, who they were talking to, and what they were saying. Who were those few targeted people? Well, I haven't told you yet, but really, it was quite obvious in the evidence. Take the Indexy app. It had around 5,000 downloads. Not a lot, but not nothing either. Anyone anywhere in the world could theoretically download it to their Android phones, but almost everyone who actually did came from one place in particular.
From the description itself, it said that it hosted a very large collection of Arabic numbers, and then the default settings of the app would specify that the user's country is Egypt. So it was really intended for that target audience. And I also saw later on that the app was being promoted on Facebook, possibly by compromised accounts. And the description on Facebook was saying, this app will give you a lot of numbers within Egypt. And this is a great service if you're within Egypt. So again, it was really aiming at that audience.
Egyptians were clearly at the center of this. But not just any Egyptians. When Amnesty International first got word of the spear phishing campaign, a pattern had arisen. Everybody who was targeted fit a very specific profile.
Another clue about the identity of the victims was that one of the domains that were involved in the phishing activities had interesting subdomains. So usually the subdomains that were used in the phishing attacks were Outlook.com or Yahoo.com, again, trying to impersonate those mailing services. But this specific domain had two subdomains that were the English transliteration of an Arabic phrase, which means the popular movement. And then looking up this exact phrase in English led me to one result only, which was a Telegram channel using the exact same spelling and the exact same phrase in English. And this Telegram channel was for a popular movement, surprise, surprise, in Egypt. And it was basically telling the users to contact the admins if they're interested in joining the popular movement, and that they should go out on the streets, and that they should start a second revolution, and that they should get angry. And again, it stressed out more than once that everyone that is interested in joining the Telegram channel should contact the admins. And of course, this could be a very effective method in tracking people that are opposed to the government and opposed to the authorities and are interested in...
It's a trap.
It's a trap, exactly.
Now, if I release a podcast episode and six people write me nasty messages on Twitter about it, and then all six of those people get sent the same malware, you can probably guess who sent that malware. The victims of our story were all Egyptian journalists, activists, and dissidents. That gives us an obvious primary suspect. Still, attribution is very sensitive in cyberspace, so Aseel and her team needed hard evidence before making any big claims.
Basically, from the Open Directory, I was able to see that there were a lot of, like I mentioned at the beginning, clues that the attackers left, which could tell me or indicate where they are coming from. So, for example, the time zone of the server was set to be that of Cairo, which is, again, if you're using a server, if you're setting up a server, you would usually set that time to your local time. So that indicated that the attackers were probably from Egypt. Some of the spelling mistakes that they made on the server, because they would document all of their code and write a lot of comments, were also indicating that they are from Egypt, and that they were making a lot of spelling mistakes and typos in English as well, and they used very bad grammar. And another very strong clue, actually, was from the administration panel of the location tracking application, which this app, or this panel to manage this app, had a map. And that map was supposed to collect all of the coordinates that the app managed to steal from the devices or to collect from the devices, and the app would zoom in to a default location, and that location pointed to a building in Cairo. And looking up that building, of course, or looking up the coordinates on Google Maps, at first showed an unnamed building, so the building didn't have a name. I couldn't tell what it is, but I did notice that it was in a kind of a walled-off area, I would say, and it was a complex of buildings, and because the building didn't really have a name, we couldn't tell what it was at first, but eventually we worked together with the reporters from the New York Times, which managed to send someone out there to check what that building was, and it was basically the headquarters of the General Intelligence Services
Wow.
in Egypt.
Jackpot. Amazing.
Yes.
And here's why this story really matters. It's not just that a few dozen people were being hacked, but that they were being hacked for political purposes by an entity with the power to do them great harm. Amnesty International has a term for the state of Egypt under its current regime. They call it an open-air prison. Our story today might give you some idea for what it's like to live in an open-air prison, where expressing your personal beliefs, saying the wrong thing, affiliating with the wrong people can open you up to the threat of constant surveillance and the threat of violence and possibly imprisonment. If you want a sense for just what the stakes are for any victim of an Egyptian government-backed cyber campaign, consider the story of Hisham Ghaffar. Ghaffar is a journalist. He was the head of an NGO called MADA for Media Development. More importantly, he was a critic of Egypt's government and its leader, Abdel al-Sisi. Hisham's political views and his willingness to express them earned him, let's say, a visit by the police in October of 2015. They politely and cordially stormed his office, grabbed him, and dragged him into a solitary confinement cell at the notoriously high-security Aqrab prison. According to Egyptian constitutional law, Hisham could have been held in pre-trial imprisonment for up to 2 years. That's even if he wasn't guilty of anything. Think of that. But it gets worse. After 1 year passed, then two, then three, it was clear that the government didn't have any plans to stick to their 2 years maximum. There was little indication that he would ever get a trial, let alone a release. According to Amnesty International, Hisham was kept in solitary during all these years. This was also technically illegal. But let's face it, the law no longer applied to Hisham. He wasn't a prisoner so much as a torture victim. From an Amnesty International article, I quote, "Hisham's family say his cell is infested by insects due to sewage leaks. There isn't natural light or ventilation, and Hisham is forced to sleep on the floor with no proper bedding or mattress. Hisham's health has deteriorated dramatically, and he is in a lot of pain. He has optic nerve atrophy in both eyes, meaning he is losing his eyesight. He also has an enlarged prostate. He is not allowed regular exercise outside the cell. Occasionally, prison guards allow him to walk along the corridor of his ward, but he is usually confined to his room." End quote. Hisham was not a victim of this cyber campaign, but that's only because he was imprisoned before it began. He's just like each of the victims we've referred to on our show today, innocent under the law, but in opposition to Egypt's ruling party. He was released finally after 3.5 years behind bars in April of 2019. But others like him remain in custody. And there will be more stories like this to come. If Checkpoint's investigation is any indicator, al-Sisi's government has only become more aggressive in targeting dissidents in recent months.
I managed to get, again, starting from kind of an old infrastructure that was reported back in March by Amnesty International, seeing that the attackers weren't really deterred by that publication. They were still registering newer websites, and they didn't stop their activity after Amnesty exposed it.
We don't know exactly what's happened to the victims of this coordinated cyber attack. Some may still be under threat. There may be more victims to come. The stakes for Egypt's boldest freethinkers have never been higher. That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. For past episodes, visit Checkpoint's research blog at research.checkpoint.com, and you can follow Checkpoint Research on Twitter or follow me at Ran Levy. That's RanLevi. CP Radio is produced by PI Media. written by Nate Nelson, produced by Guy B. Noon, and edited and narrated by me, Ran Levy. See you next episode. Bye-bye.